Andy Niles, who's with the OSU Vet College and the Vet Hospital specifically, trying to keep track of things over there, and does a lot of large animal type work. So, you know, I always have to make sure I recruit people to do large animals, because doggy kitty conversation out here doesn't really cut it for me. So, you know, they're important to lots of people, but this is an ag show.
Well, that's good, because I don't know. It's been a long time since I've worked on dogs and cats.
Not even farm dogs?
Not very many of those come into the hospital.
I'm guessing not.
At least our side of the hospital.
I'm guessing not. Okay, Andy, I remember, right, you've been over there, is it pushing 10 years
pushing
already?
10 years, yeah. I never thought that I would be in academia. I figured that I would go into private practice when I graduated vet school, and I decided to pursue an internship and some residencies and specialization opportunities, with a thought in the back of my mind that I'd always go back and buy a truck and just drive the countryside. And I kind of fell in love with the teaching part of it. That's kept me at OSU.
Yeah, that's. I think there have been a few of us that have had that happen, hang around OSU because of that. Anyway, Andy's here. I wanted to talk a little bit with him about what's going on over at the medical center these days. There at the vet hospital, as I will always call it, even though it's now the medical center.
Veterinary medical.
Sorry, the veterinary medical. Let's put an ER in there, even, aren't I? Oh, well. I said earlier, I almost got hit by a construction vehicle the other day. You've got some building going on over there. Pretty active place again. We went through a few years where I think some of us were wondering what the future was. Gotten pretty doggone active, and now you're building.
Yeah, it is. Now, the building predominantly is the small animal side of the hospital expanding.
Well, sure.
We're going to get some additional teaching spaces and things like that, but we're definitely busy, and I think with the expansion, it's sort of brought the veterinary center, the veterinary medical center, to, you know, people's attention, and I think becoming more well known around the area.
Yeah, a lot of people don't think about large animal there on campus. I mean, we do have our practice out of Marysville, and those guys, they run around all over the countryside in a truck, like you were talking about. But we do get quite a few large animals coming in. You said earlier, a lot of times these are specialized critters or special cases. What are you seeing in the practice these days?
Yeah, it is, as you mentioned, sort of an interesting location to have large animal. I mean, we're right in the heart of the city, and to be driving a trailer and cattle down there, but they do it, I think people are starting to become more and more aware that we are there, and that we're there to serve them. We do work in combination with veterinarians at home on the farm for many cases, although we will see, you know, individual animals that people just decide to bring in. The types of cases that we see oftentimes, you know, high dollar genetic seed stock, we will see, you know, pet animals that have more of sort of a companion association to them.
The llama.
Exactly. Llamas, alpacas, sheep, goats, lot. We see a lot of pet pigs. I mean, that's something that we deal with a lot. But then we see other true agricultural animals as well, and that's probably, I would say, makes up the other half of what we, you know, what we take care of.
I know for many years, before some of the changes that occurred, we used to have quite a few horses coming in and out of there. What's that side of the practice looking like? The equine side?
The equine side, I think, is doing better. We had a couple of years that it was slowed
right
down a bit. I think it's starting to pick back up, which is certainly a good thing. And I, although I don't specifically work on horses, I mean, I have a really good working relationship with the other equine veterinarians that are there, and we will oftentimes collaborate on cases if it's something that, you know, the specific disease that may be analogous to something that horses get, and they may have more experience with it. We certainly, you know, kind of put our minds together and try to, you know, come up with plans.
Well, and of course, when we have Kentucky sitting right down the road with their equine business, I know they poached additional stuff out of Ohio, and otherwise they're kind of the big dog there. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about some of the kinds of cases that seem to be showing up most this period of the year.
Yeah, so, you know, the types of things that we see, we talked last hour about, you know, the problems that pet goats get. You know, we see things like neurologic disease from just different management things that may predispose them to having deficiencies in certain things or other infectious causes. We see block animals. That's a super common thing that we see where especially pet and show type, the sheep and goats, they'll have problems with urinary stones. We see those problems in cattle as well, not to the certainly to the frequency that we see it, and it's largely due to management type differences.
Is it typically a dietary issue?
Typically a dietary issue. That's correct. And usually it's animals that are on high concentrated.
That's what I wondered.
So high cereal grain diet,
right?
Is going to predispose.
I didn't ask you the last time. We don't have a real big crowd right now, so I got to get amused up here.
Yeah.
What's the weirdest case you've seen in the last 6 months?
Oh, the weirdest case. I don't know. We have quite a few weird ones that come in.
Well,
it may not be the case itself, but maybe the circumstances that brought that case to the hospital.
Okay.
I think I mentioned the one that I just kind of briefly mentioned, the one that was, you know, hit by a car. We see hit by a car is a lot in small animal.
Right.
Not so much in, you know, with a 1,000-pound heifer that's walking across the fairground somewhere.
Yeah.
And it gets
well, and that's
over.
Even
so,
that was even more unique. It was on the fairgrounds or right by the fairgrounds.
Yeah,
it wasn't like Farmer Jones' cattle got out and were standing on the other side of the curb.
Right, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, you know, and I won't ask you what the weirdest patient owner was that came in the last 6 months.
We're not going to go there.
Let's. One of the things that we were talking a little bit about the last hour was this whole business of drug use in livestock and other animals. Sure. Also, the residue issues is part of that discussion. There are food safety parts of that discussion. We didn't mention it last hour, but you know there are some drug use by humans issues that are part of some of that discussion and stuff that floats out there. Where are you? What are you guys keeping the most of an eye on these days? And what kinds of advice are you giving to producers to say, hey, give my critter a shot?
Yeah. So the one of the biggest issues is residues.
Sure.
As you hit on, and that's probably the biggest thing that we're keeping an eye on, because the law mandates that we're, you know, not allowing these residues to be in violation of threshold levels when these animals either go to slaughter or when the milk is shipped. And so that, you know, we need to be conscious of that every single day.
Well, and that slips right into the human food safety issue so quickly.
Yeah. And I mean, the other side of the coin is resistance problems, and that's going to take longer for us to actually see problems with that. But, you know, that's certainly something we've got to be aware of for not only today, but, you know, for years down the road. Are we using these drugs now that may be effective, but if we don't use them properly in 5 years from now to treat the same disease, they may not be effective anymore if we allow these things to become resistant. And those things are tightly interrelated, but a slightly different emphasis on different parts of the problem.
I guess one of the questions I didn't ask you last hour, you're often dealing with the one-off type animal as opposed to the larger farm practice where, you know, maybe they've got a better handle on the residue question and all because they're shipping food. But with all the attention in the last several years towards antibiotic resistance or chemical resistance in plants, those types of things, are you seeing your clients coming in with a little higher knowledge or on that, or they still aren't there?
Some are, some aren't. And it's, you know, I certainly, you know, part of my job to educate them if they're not on par with, you know, the current regulations and B, just the science behind those regulations. And it's easy for people to develop that mindset that this, my animal's sick. And what does it need? It needs antibiotics. It needs antibiotics and vanamine. I mean, those are the things that we.
It's just like my kid's sick. Give her an antibiotic.
That's right. And There's a lot of diseases, a lot of conditions that antibiotics aren't going to treat.
Sure.
Antibiotics are certainly very useful,
right,
and they may be part of the treatment to, say, even, you know, a surgical type condition where we're going to manage it surgically and then put them on some type of prophylactic antibiotic to keep them from getting sick, or, you know, to treat, you know, secondary problems. And certainly they're very useful, and we use them. I don't know what I would do if we didn't have
them. Well, I mean, it's cruel not to in those cases.
That's right. And then, like you said, I mean, that's the animal welfare piece of the puzzle if you don't use it.
No, it's the production piece of the puzzle.
Right.
It's cruel to me by not treating that animal to make it better, because my bottom line is going
to
get worse. I'm going to be a nasty capitalist here right now for the moment, okay?
And I mean, you know, if we use them willy-nilly without the knowledge of the disease, the knowledge of the specific animal it's going into, and then this is where it becomes really tough for us when we're only seeing that individual animal. Do we know what happens to that animal when it goes back to the farm? And so then we need to use drugs that have reasonable withdrawal times and things, because if we prescribe a drug that has, you know, a very extended, prolonged withdrawal that's years, and there are a few drugs out there that, even though they're legal to use in animals, and there may be, you know, specific times when they're needed, you know, we send them home, and we know that these animals are going to have residues in their system maybe a couple years down the road. And can we reasonably know where that animal is if she stops producing, or if even if this valuable show animal that this person says today is the most valuable thing ever, and I want you to do everything for it, and it'll never, you know, leave the farm, it's going to die and be buried on the farm, can we be absolutely certain when she doesn't win the show anymore, and, you know, a year and a half down the road, after we forgot what we did with them, where is this animal going to go? Is it going to enter the food chain? And a lot of them do. And so that's something we have to be really, really cautious of. And not saying that there is not a time and a place to do that. And that's where it becomes really important that we have a really good working relationship with the veterinarians that work on the farm themselves, that have a little bit better idea of what these animals are, you know, what their kind of management schemes are. Do they have the ability to kind of monitor this animal? Do they have the ability to make sure they tag it and say, this animal is not to be shipped for X number of months, whatever. Because I don't, you know, when I'm seeing that one patient.
Okay, I guess one of the questions I probably should have asked you before, but roughly what percentage of the large animals that you deal with come with an attached relationship with a vet that you then have, you're able to work with a local vet versus the person who just pulls up with their stock trailer and says, hey, fix my calf?
That's a great question. And we see both.
I know you do.
And certainly we don't turn people away if they come and say, you know, I've got this cow. We always ask them, you know, do you have a veterinarian at home, and who is that? Because we would like to at least let them know that they're here.
Right.
This is what we did, even if we don't give them drugs. If, you know, this is what we did, this is follow-up, you know, so they can kind of put those in their records. I would say 80%+. Now, this is just strictly kind of shooting from the hip. But I would say 80% or so of the animals that come into our clinic are brought in on a referral type basis.
Okay.
So, you know, I usually get a call from a veterinarian and say, this is what I'm seeing in the field, and this is why I think it needs to come down to OSU. Oftentimes, I'm already, you know, kind of down the path of actually getting a treatment plan together for that animal, perhaps even before that animal arrives.
Right, right. Because in some cases, I'm guessing a vet may refer because they don't have the capacity to handle that animal for whatever the treatment might be.
That is correct.
Okay, Andy, we've got a few folks out here, and I'm wondering if they happen to have any questions for you, or if they're just sitting in the shade. Some of them are. I know a couple of them aren't just sitting in the shade, but they don't have any questions. So, anyway, what else do we need to hit before we run out of time here?
One of the big things that I see now too, and this is when I said before I was going to go back and
the rumination.
Yeah. One thing that I kind of thought of, and I think it's certainly a big concern from the large animal veterinary world, is some of the under, especially underprivileged areas of the state in Appalachia and things. I mean, they ask about, you know, our senior students, well, are you going to come down and do large animal? We need large animal vets in our area. Right. And there seems to be somewhat of a deficiency there. And that is a huge concern. One of the things that drives that, and I don't want to get too much into the economics because I know that's one of your areas.
I'm going to drag you into that a little bit because it's an issue.
But that is an issue where, you know, the students, they're leaving vet school now with a lot of debt. And probably the average, I mean, we're well over $100,000 in debt when they leave. And it's easier, just quite frankly, and more lucrative for them to treat dogs and cats in an office where they can see, you know, 15 dogs and cats in the time it takes them to make two or three farm calls. And so it's really economic driven. I know a lot of students, they would love to you know, do large animal veterinary medicine, and their hands are tied because of some of these economic regulations. So that's certainly a concern. I don't know if I have the answers to fix that right now. Certainly the agriculture and the economics associated with that, as far as the beef prices and other things, as you know, that as agriculture starts to do well, I think that will hopefully help to kind of feed into some of these other subsidiary types of occupations that work closely with the agricultural community.
We would hope so. I know one of the things that I've thought about this a little bit because I've got a few friends that are vets, and I've known a few others who wanted to be large animal vets, and for that very reason, they just couldn't pull it off. Or what I know, I think we talked about maybe last year, the other thing that happens is get up to about, let's even say your age, get about there, and it starts getting a little tougher to deal with. There's like, I have a friend, and I'm just waiting for her to give up on her love of treating dairy cows because, you know, she's pushing an age where, you know, doesn't want to get beat up quite as much as you naturally do. We've got other areas. I mean, you talk about Southeast Ohio. They may need large animal vet services. They do need large animal vet services out there, but there's not enough total veterinary practice to support very many veterinarians down there. And as we go west in the plain states where they're spread out even more, might have bigger operations, but is that enough? Those are issues I don't know that we've figured out how to manage in more of an economic systems approach. And I don't know whether it's, you guys are going to be operating free clinics in Appalachia for the cows and pigs of cows and sheep of Appalachia.
And there are some, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that. Certainly there are some programs available for like loan repayment type programs and things like that for some of these students that are going into that area to try to encourage them. Those are usually short-term things, you know, where they have a few-year commitment and then they're done with that. But, and a lot of them are, you know, choosing to go into, you know, some other type of veterinary type activity.
All right. Well, Andy, I don't know that we have any other questions, but we're just about out of time. I'm supposed to kick you out of here right about now. I do want to thank you for coming out again this year.
Thank you, Stan. I appreciate it.
Thank your goats for not having an emergency this morning.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Anyway, Andy Nyhouse with the OSU Veterinary Medical Center, and I even said it right that time. We're going to